to order. Sunday about 1:15. We have three bills on schedule, and then we're also going to bring up HB 150, radiologic technicians, under bills previously heard and scheduled. First, Senator Bundy's here, Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, Co-Chair Wilkin, and myself, Senator Green. And we have first on the agenda, HB 51, Employers Association for Workers' Comp Insurance. Mike, you're back.
Back.
Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
We also have three people online, and Robert Vogel, Dave Kester, and Mike Combs to testify. And we have some folks here in the room as well. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In light of that you have people to testify, I'll keep my comments relatively short. I'll start off with the basic premise for House Bill 51, and that's that in the state of Alaska, a single employer is currently allowed to self-insure for workers' compensation obligations if they meet certain requirements. 26% of Alaska's employees work for an employer that self-insures their workers' compensation obligations. What House Bill 51 does is it allows a group of small employers to bind themselves together through joint and several liability to, in the aggregate, meet similar requirements to what a single employer is required to meet to self-insure their workers' compensation obligations. That's the basic premise behind the bill. And on the other side, I would then speak to, I understand there's a Senate CS for the CS.
Yes, there is. We need to move the CS. I'll move Senate CS for House Bill 51, Senate Finance CS version R, and we'll object for explanation.
Madam Chair, on behalf of the sponsor, I'd like to thank the Senate Finance Committee for the work that they did in the Senate Finance CS. I believe what has happened in the Senate Finance CS is that you have closed the last procedural and workable loopholes in the bill. And I walk through the changes just very quickly. On page 4, line 12 through 14, in subsection C, a sentence was deleted that an association of self-insured employers shall have the rights and obligations of an employer under AS 2330. That was deleted because a previous Department of Labor amendment recognized the self-insured association as an insurer, and you couldn't be considered an insurer and an employer at the same time. So that was a technical correction. The next change was on page 5, line 11 through 12. Concern was expressed in previous hearings about the fact that the people performing claims, that the Division of Insurance didn't have adequate oversight over them. Lines 11 through 12 require that those providing claim facilities are through independent, licensed, and importantly, resident adjusters. Being a small association, we think it's appropriate that the person providing claims should be a resident in the state performing those duties. The third change is on page 12, beginning on line 30. And going all the way through line 7 on page 14. This change was language suggested by the Division of Insurance to us, and what it does is it provides a mechanism to unwind the association, go into receivership, and provides what I believe the division's testified into previous committees as a guarantee mechanism. That, in addition to the surety solvency bonds, auditing assessments, and all the other financial controls in the bill, I believe bring the bill back to what is fundamentally a policy decision.
What was the start of the delete?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
What was the beginning line of the delete?
The beginning line was on page 12, line 30.
Thank you.
We rewrote the entire section about insolvency. The final change is on page 16, and since House Bill 51 is a companion bill to Senate Bill 241 by Senator Cowdery, which passed out of Senate Labor and Commerce, we added in language from an amendment that was offered in Senate Labor and Commerce to keep to the will of the committee there. And Madam Chair, that's the bill. The fundamental policy decision I think you will be asked to make by both the division and the members of the small business community that are asking for this bill is whether or not small employers should be allowed to bind themselves together and take advantage of an option on the table. It doesn't address the larger problems with workers' compensation, but it adds another tool to the tool chest for businesses trying to deal with this issue in the state. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for the sponsor staff? We have some more folks online, as I said, to testify, and I'm sure they'll bring some light to it as well. Robert Vogel with the Anchorage Home Builders. Hocknett.
Hello, this is Robert Vogel. I'm with Probit Management. I'm an administrator of self-insured groups for self-insured groups in Nevada. I'm here primarily to answer any questions that you might have, since I do run self-insured groups, and a lot of this language of this law is based on the law that we have here in Nevada. I would just like to say that this is an alternative for the employers, smaller employers, that can't take advantage of the single self-insured law to bind together and take advantage and have the same advantage as larger employers. With what I believe is lots of financial guarantees towards solvency. You know, single self-insureds there only require a $5 million tangible net worth, and this bill provides for a $10 million tangible net worth. And as Mr. Pulaski said, there are many other financial guarantees mechanisms in this bill that would benefit the smaller businesses in Alaska to bind together and have this as an alternative.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Vogel? Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Hello again, Mr. Vogel. I understand that this has worked fairly well in Nevada. Did we incorporate all of the basic Nevada laws in this law?
Yes, sir. It worked well in about 37 states as well, and every state has some unique differences based upon their own particular differences in law. In Nevada, and as many other states, the laws following the self-insured, or the laws for groups follow the single self-insured laws, and there are some differences. In Nevada, the tangible net worth is only $2.5 million for groups to form, because that's what it was for single self-insured. There are some other basic differences between states, Nevada and many other states, California as well. So I think that we covered most of the ones that sort of fit within the Alaska framework.
Yeah, did we leave out anything that would have been a substantial benefit to us, if I might?
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Stedman.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I'm just kind of curious if we could have a little bit of testimony from him on the differences in just the size of the employee base, employer base from Nevada to Alaska, because we know we have a very shallow market here. So there's got to be some demographic differences.
Could you give us some population comparisons?
When the law passed in Nevada in 1993, Nevada had about a population of about 800,000 people. It has since grown in the last, since 1993 when the law was initially passed. Obviously, it's been a fast-growing state. But at that time, there was less than a million people in the state. I also administered a group in New Mexico when the law was passed in 1991, I believe. There they had a sparse population spread out throughout the state, less than a million people. And so those are the comparisons at the time that those laws passed. Now currently, Nevada has 13 self-insured groups. Covering auto dealers, home builders, trucking and transportation, retail, and some public municipality group. New Mexico has about 14 or 15 groups covering similar types of businesses around the state, and they've all been very viable during that time. Contrast that with a state like California, which passed their law in the early 1990s. They didn't have any self-insured groups until the year 2000. And they have passed reforms to change their workers' comp system there, and they've seen lots of benefits. But at the same time, when they passed those benefits, They've had now 20 self-insured groups form, and according to the director of labor there who regulates those, I think there's about 60 more in the pipeline to be formed, maybe 40, for a total of 60. So, you know, the largest state, the biggest workers' comp market, didn't have self-insured groups, even though they had the law, until they passed the reforms, and now they're seeing the self-insured groups start forming.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. And of all these groups, have any of them become insolvent? That's a huge concern of mine. Of should they, in spite of all their best intentions, become insolvent? And if they have or were to become insolvent, where's the fallback position? Where does the injured worker go? Who is ultimately responsible in Nevada and California?
In the states that I refer to, they all have a joint and several agreement. None of the groups have been become insolvent. And in fact, in Nevada, the groups have thrived very well. The groups that we manage have, over a period of 10 years, generated a healthy surplus for their members, and have been very, very solvent. The other groups in the state are in a similar position. We speak with the other administrators on a regular basis because it is a concern that the groups remain healthy. In New Mexico, none of the groups ever went insolvent. And as reported by the director of California, none of those groups have been become insolvent. But if a group does become insolvent, one of the things you look to is that tangible net worth, and that's why I think the Alaska law went above and beyond in raising that to $10 million. You know, if a group is insolvent, doesn't have cash to pay its bills when they come due, the benefits primarily to the injured workers, then that net worth is a measure of the strength of the members underlying that, and that is their creditability to go out and borrow money or be able to pay those debts as they come due. Additionally, every group has excess insurance, which protects it against those catastrophic losses that might occur. For example, if there was an injured worker involved in a fire and was burned, and which is one of the worst injuries you could have, and the most expensive ones, and a qualified excess insurer stands in for the group. Basically, the group would have a limit or a deductible of the first $500,000 or maybe $750,000 of that claim as it's paid out. And as we know, workers' comp claims are a long-tail claim, and those excess carriers are very valuable, very important feature of the protection of the group. Additionally, you know, the group in this law has a solvency requirement, post-solvency bond, a surety bond, a letter of credit, or some other instrument to fall back upon should that group not be able to pay the bills as they come due. But you've got the businesses there. They're going to be healthy businesses with their $10 million or more tangible net worth. And we're not looking at just having 5 members or 6 members in a group. You're going to have hopefully 10 or 15 or 20 so that, you know, they're all contributing towards that. They're all joining a common cause, and they understand that they're signing that joint and several and making that long-term commitment to have stability in their workers' comp.
Thank you. One more.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you for your patience. And one of the concerns I hear in Alaska is, for lack of a better term, called cherry picking. This group that would set aside and wouldn't be perhaps great demands on the regular workers' comp system, and so there will be fewer and fewer participants, so then the cost has to be higher and higher for each participant. Are you aware of any impact on the workers' comp rates in New Mexico or Nevada or California? Are they, like everywhere else, tending up?
They're like everywhere else for the most part. California most recently had some significant reforms, and they've had some significant drops in their pricing, upwards of 40% or more. depending upon which person or which journal you read, I've heard 40 or 46% since they enacted the reforms. But generally, across the market in the United States, and was true in California until the reforms were put in place, you know, prices across the board were being raised. In New Mexico, when the groups were put into play first, it didn't have a significant impact in the market. It actually was able to help strengthen the market. They had a large percentage of their employers in the assigned risk pool. We believe, at least from the group side, that we helped stabilize that market, and insurers came back into the market and were more competitive, providing a better service and at a better price, and it has stabilized in New Mexico for many years now. We see the same thing in Nevada. We're a little bit different. You know, every state is a little bit different. It was a monopolistic system when the group started. Rates were high and were going up. However, the last several years, 4 to 5 years, I believe, the overall rates in the market have dropped consistently, 2 to 3% a year, I believe, in the standard market. And insurers came in when there was only a monopolistic state. There was just the one carrier, then groups were formed. Now there's over 200 insurers in the state of Nevada covering workers' comp. Not in any big, a lot of them obviously are just covering a small part of that population, but it's helped maintain rates. And, you know, the groups are not necessarily cherry picking. They're trying to find the right match for their industry group that they're in. A lot of the people who came to join groups out of New Mexico and Nevada came out of the assigned risk pool. They didn't have a carrier to cover them. And so it really benefited the state to have those come out of the assigned risk pool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us today.
And I'll remain online if there's any other questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Vogel.
You're welcome.
Dave Kester, you're off net.
Yes, Chairperson Green, this is Dave Kester.
Go right ahead. If you'd give your name and who you work for or who you represent and begin your testimony.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Dave Kester, and I'm here representing the Workers' Compensation Committee of Alaska, or the WCCA. And I'm here to testify in opposition to the House Bill 51, or the committee substitutes for that. I'm here to testify against it for several concerns that I have. First concern is I see that this is an unnecessary legislation, because right now the Alaska statutes currently provide regulations allowing for the formation of what's called reciprocal insurance arrangements for groups of employers. And to give you some examples, there are groups that have been formed for many years, the Alaska Timber Exchange, the Alaska Municipal League Joint Insurance Association, or the AML-JIA, and ARECA, or the Alaska Rural Electric Co-op Association, have all been formed in this state over the years and have a proven track record of success. These have been formed, these reciprocal arrangements were formed by groups of associated employers looking for an affordable alternative to rising workers' compensation costs, but are still subject to the state regulations designed to protect injured workers, employers, and insurers. Again, since there's current regulations already adequately providing for these arrangements, there really is no need for passing this legislation. Secondly, the bill is designed in a way that will exempt these groups from the much-needed regulation and financial oversight from the Division of Insurance. With so much at stake, it would be wrong to allow these groups to operate without regulatory oversight by the Division of Insurance. Without this financial and operational oversight by the Division, I'm concerned that injured Alaskans would suffer financial ruin in the event of a group's insolvency and inability to pay an injured Alaskan worker's compensation claim. Similarly, I'm concerned even with some of the House Committee's financial enhancements and that the bill still lacks provisions to ensure adequate financial strength and guarantee mechanisms within these group programs. Without adequate financial provisions, and since the members of the group are jointly and severally liable for all payment of compensation to injured employees in the group, there is a substantial risk of businesses suffering a significant financial burden. And this financial risk could have a devastating financial effect on a small business in the group and potentially could force a small employer into bankruptcy. I believe some of the reasons that the reciprocal arrangements have succeeded in this state is that they have the necessary financial security and regulatory oversight by the Division of Insurance, much the same as all workers' compensation insurers in this state. This regulatory oversight is the best way to protect Alaskan businesses, injured workers, and all consumers in this state. I was not aware that there was an addition or an amendment, committee amendment, with the increase from net worth requirements from $5 million to $10 million until just a few minutes ago when it was mentioned. However, if you do the math, and we're talking about 15 or 20 groups, even at $10 million, that would be an average net worth per business of just $500,000. And, you know, routinely we see single workers' compensation claims, you know, well into hundreds or $200,000. That's not unusual just because of the costs that are associated with some of these claims. So I'm still very, very concerned, even with the increase in the net worth requirements, that the $10 million is still adequate per group. And then lastly, I'm concerned that this legislation has not had the support of the Director of Insurance, Linda Hall. This lack of support and consistent opposition throughout the House and Senate committees really should signal a huge red flag to this committee. Director Hall's expertise is well respected in the business, insurance, and most importantly, the legislative community. And her concerns and opposition to this legislation should be heeded. I would urge this committee to not pass this legislation until all of these concerns that I've mentioned and also the director's concerns are addressed adequately. I want to thank Chairperson Green and Wilkins and the rest of the Senate Finance Committee for their attention to this legislation and for allowing me the opportunity to testify in opposition to it. I would be very happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for Mr. Kester? Thank you very much for being with us today. And Ma'am Palmer, Mike Combs?
Yes, this is Mike Combs. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Mike. Go ahead. Give your title.
Senator Green, Senator Wilkins, thank you for letting me testify today. I represent the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers Incorporated. I'm the president of the association. We were down in Juneau here a while back, and we did pass out some information on the position that the Alaska Association has on this bill. We are opposed to the bill. We are opposed to it for several reasons, and the primary reason is that just about 11 months ago, these same folks were back in Juneau for workers' comp reform. You had a special session just to address that issue alone, and really and truly those provisions that you made and changed have not even had a chance to work. The paint is not dry on them at this point. We're just starting to see what can happen with reform. As the one gentleman testified, that workers' comp reform in California had a substantial effect not only on the premiums but also those that participated in the market for workers' comp. I'd like to see us at least give the reform that we started with last year given a chance to work and see what happens at that point. The bill as presented has joint and several liability, but it does not have personal indemnification. And so the only The only access you're going to have to the members themselves that are part of this group is through their business assets. And as you know, business assets can be set up as corporations and can be fairly shallow if necessary to protect the individual that actually owns the business. There is no cross-indemnity between the particular groups that would be set up under this legislation, whereas on the insurance industry, if one insurer goes insolvent, the other insurers within the state actually have to pick up that tab and pay for it in the Guarantee Act that actually fund the programs for insolvent payment of claims. So that safety net is not available at this point. We would like to see, if this does go through, we would like to see personal identification added and also the cross liability between groups of different organizations that go under this particular legislation. The other thing is to keep in mind is that group self-insurance is actually the definition of insurance. When insurance is formed, it is to pool and group funds together to pay claims. That's the original concept behind insurance, and that's what happens in the standard industry. What we're doing is we're creating many insurance companies that are doing the same thing that's available to them now under the current markets. I'm concerned on how rates are going to be developed. There's no mechanism for developing rates other than what the, I didn't see anything in the legislation that included how rates were going to be developed, what was going to be charged to their members. As far as I know, these groups may not be members of the National Council on Compensation Insurance and therefore not have access to those rate-making body. So it'd be interesting to see what their avenue of rate-making is going to be. As Dave Kester testified, there are mechanisms available currently, and as the Director of Insurance, Linda Hall, has also testified, reciprocal is a preferred method. It does ensure accountability for all the members and does go under the Division of Insurance regulatory approval process. I think we've tried to make our position fairly known on this one, but if there's any questions I can answer, I'd certainly be available.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Are there any questions for Mr. Combs? Thank you for joining us today. Kenton Bryan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Kenton Bryan from the Property Casualty Insurers Association. I'm located in Olympia, Washington, and I appreciate the opportunity to join you this afternoon. I have testified before other committees on this issue, and some of you might have heard from me before. We tend to share some of the same concerns that you've already heard today from the WCCA and from the agent community, but I also, I guess, wanted to point out a couple of things that might not have been raised just yet. One is, earlier it was alluded to that workers' compensation claims are long-tail claims, and obviously that means that claims are paid out over a long period of time, depending on the type of injury and how long that worker is injured, and I can tell you that there is a current ongoing claim for one of our member companies operating in Alaska that is for which they have set aside reserves of $7.7 million. That's just one claim for one injured worker. And I think that underscores the continuing concern that even at a $10 million financial level, there's continuing concern that may not be enough over time in some cases. But let me also just go back and say that from the start, the PCI's position on this legislation hasn't been that we oppose the formation of these groups. It's been that we oppose the formation of the groups if they're not adequately regulated and there isn't adequate protection against insolvency. And although I must apologize that I've not seen the new substitute, so I've heard the description of it, but I've not seen it, and so I can't really comment as to whether our concerns are taken care of in this new version. Every version that we've seen up to this point has not adequately persuaded us or our members that protection exists for injured workers if there is an insolvency, nor have we heard the Director of Insurance at any time say, well, this takes care of my concerns, and so we feel that we can work with these entities. Insurance companies like competition. We like working in states where there are a number of insurers working, and for that reason, we welcome new entities insuring injured workers in the state of Alaska. However, we like fair competition, and we don't believe that when you set up a system that allows people to basically opt out of the traditional insurance system and take on a new alternative kind of system, in which self-insured groups don't have to pay premium taxes, they don't have to form self-insurance insolvency associations for the payment of claims in the event of an insolvency and things of this nature, that that we're operating on a level playing field with our competitors. And that we do not like and find it a difficult environment to work in. And I think it's also been pointed out in the committee and throughout the legislative process that Alaska has a challenging workers' compensation market. And this is, of course, no surprise to any of you who have worked on this issue over the years. Last year, the Alaska legislature did some incredibly good work on taking steps toward reforming the workers' compensation system. That is the right direction to take. Things that address costs are the right direction to take. Things that allow businesses to opt out of the current system and into a different system, leaving those who stay behind in the other market facing an even smaller and tighter pool of insurance, is not the way to go, and we would appreciate you rejecting this legislation at this time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brine. And in this room, Ray Hickel. Good morning.
Madam Chair.
Afternoon.
Go ahead. I apologize, I got something wrong with my voice today. My name is Ray Hickel. I'm president of the Anchorage Home Builders Association. Anchorage Home Builders just chose to lead the charge on this. We have a lot of support because we need relief in our industry. 22% for a carpenter and 50% for a roofer isn't that okay. We do need some relief. Also, throughout this whole process, and it's been a very difficult one, we were open to change. We tried to work and rewrite. When we had input, we took it and we used it. I just wanted to demonstrate to the committee that we wanted to show our resolve on this issue. We will stick with it and work to do what's right, to change it, to amend it, and do what's right for our workers. And that's all I have.
Thank you very much, Ray, for being here. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoy your comments on a couple of issues that came up here. One of them is that this kind of an association is already permissible under state law, and we don't necessarily need to do what's in this bill for businesses to aggregate together.
In a short, non-technical answer, reciprocals are top-heavy and they waste money.
Okay, I don't understand what, I need more information than that. I don't understand what reciprocal means in this context and why it wastes money.
Okay, well, that's just a builder term. If we want to get Robert back on the line to answer the technical side of it, I know that in comparison, we have large companies, don't want to name names, have the choice between a reciprocal and a self-insured group, and you see that what we're approaching 20-30% of the workforce is in that, and I imagine those guys are pretty sharp at the numbers.
Thank you. That answer is absolutely of no value to me, and so on. But let's go on to something maybe you can help me with. Mm-hmm. It was represented here that there's not enough of financial strength in these groups to handle the claims that may come up.
Okay, what I do know about the bill is that we also have reinsurance. Now, with the joint and several liability for the catastrophic cases, as one gentleman commented to, we do have the reinsurance to cover that. And currently now, $5 million and 100 employees get you to that point if you want to do it yourself as a single company. And if I could get Robert on the phone, if you'd like to ask him those technical questions.
I'll come back to it. Thank you.
Is there any further questions, Senator Tyson?
Not from this witness at this time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ray, for being here with us today.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Asanke, are you here to testify?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Paul F. Lasanke. I'm the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I'd like to offer a few brief comments to try and aid the committee in their thoughts and then yield the majority of your time to my co-director, Linda Hall, from the Division of Insurance, and then I would certainly be available to answer any additional questions that would fall in our purview. The Department of Labor is certainly not against the basic premise of self-insurance for workers' compensation liability. We have had a program that we have administered that has been on the books in Alaska for 47 years, which I would characterize as successful. That program is administered by my division, and I do take part in the day-to-day activities of the Southern panel of the Workers' Compensation Board, which is the primary panel which makes determinations of whether a single employer is allowed to be self-insured for workers' comp liability. I would like to just draw a distinction which is subtle, but I think won't elude you. You'll understand how it fits in. It is true that right now the regulations that we operate under talk about a minimum net asset value of $5 million. But in our system, our primary focus by statute is actually the financial capability of the company that seeks to be self-insured to meet its obligations, not just now, but as you've heard from other witnesses, 20, 30 years down the road, because workers' compensation benefits can be awarded for a long period of time. For example, permanent total disability to a younger injured worker could go 30, 40 years. So we focus on financial ability to pay. So I guess I would characterize the net asset in the current system as just a basic qualification that you have to prove up before you're even entitled to ask us to authorize you to self-insure your workers' compensation liability. It is in no way, shape, or form a punch list item where as soon as you have a $5 million net worth, you're assumed financially capable of insuring your workers' compensation liabilities for this 30, 40-year period. The second point that I'd like to touch on just briefly is you've heard reference to the excess insurance that would be required under this bill so that if an individual self-insured group gets a very large workers' compensation claim, that its exposure is limited to some degree by this excess insurance kicking in. That's absolutely true. That's something that we do have in our current program as well, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. But what I'd like to point out, and I looked at our records a little bit, we have in the state of Alaska had a few self-insured employers that did indeed go out of business. I don't think that any of them went out of business because of their workers' compensation liability. And so what I'd like to focus on is that the risk that I would say that you need to focus on, as any entity that's allowing someone to self-insure, the risk is not just the specific workers' compensation liability. The risk is any other requirements that they have. For example, many large corporations have been brought down by self-insuring their health insurance as well. There is an economic risk that is very difficult to anticipate many years down the road. Is this company that looks very strong and very large right now, maybe even a market leader like AT&T was before the deregulation of the telecommunications industry, is it going to be in that same strong market leading condition 20 years down the road when someone needs their permanent total disability check to be cut? And that will segue into my last point, because I know this is very important, but time is critical this time of year. When I started out in workers' compensation, it was about 22 years ago, and I started as a hearing officer for the Division of Workers' Compensation. And one of the earlier cases of dispute that I had to deal with was how to try and get money passed through from the state second injury fund to pay the benefits to a gentleman who had been injured working for Ween Airlines when they were self-insured, and then Ween Airlines, as we all know, went out of business. we had to kind of stand on our heads, to use a non-legal term, to get that pass-through money to that person so that they would have their benefits paid. The workers' compensation structure requires, in many instances, that the employer or the insurer, whichever is the case, which accrued the liability, is around to receive this pass-through money. We rendered a decision, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that was managed to figure out a way to do that. It was criticized by a lot of the people at the time, and I think based on, for purely academic reasons, they were absolutely right. I mean, we really did stand on our heads to get this done. But at least the benefits were paid. And the reason it's fresh in my mind, besides the fact it was one of the first ones I dealt with, and now here I am 22 years later, and I'm actually at the head of the table of workers' compensation. But it was only a year or two ago, Madam Chairman, that the individual injured worker who had to rely on our sleight of hand to get their benefits, unfortunately, passed away, and their benefits claim actually ended. So for a period of 20 years, it kept going. And so consequently, I'm very sensitive to the overall finality of making a decision that says this entity can be self-insured now, and if they injure somebody, it's solely their responsibility to pay those benefits for 20 or 25 or 30 years. Thank you very much for your time and attention. And
thank
if you,
you
do have
much.
Any questions, I will remain in the room, of course.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes, I have several questions. There was a comment earlier about the rates being in around 30-40% or so, and then there's other comments earlier that there's in Nevada like 13 groups in or that have opted out of the normal workers' comp group and formed their own little association. So are we going to be faced with, in your opinion, an exodus of and get into an adverse selection within the workers' comp and start compounding a problem we're trying to fix? Or
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I would defer most of the answer to that question to Director Hall, but I would, from what I have heard and discussions I've had with her, I could certainly see that as a viable concern. And I did note in answer to one of your earlier questions that because Alaska is a very large geographical entity, but we have a small population, I did actually go and try and see how our sister states are dealing with the smaller ones. And there are, if recollection serves correctly, of the seven states in District Columbia that, along with Alaska, have fewer than a million people, there are four states that do not allow self-insurance groups, although Idaho, one of those four, allows electrical utilities only to do it, and I have no insight as to why that happened. There are two that allow it, provided that there is one has a guarantee fund and one has a guarantee mechanism, and there is only one small population state, I believe it's Vermont, that allows self-insured groups without either a self-insurance guarantee fund or a guarantee mechanism.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. You know, the legislature spent a lot of time and did a lot of work and tried to help resolve the workers' comp through some reform, the workers' compensation structure through reform. And that, my understanding is that is just starting to be felt within the marketplace and things are getting better, not worse. And could you elaborate on that? Is that accurate or inaccurate?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, again, I would like to defer the insurance industry questions to Director Hall. However, I do know from conversations with her that, and my own observation, Senator, that I believe things are starting to improve. But I'd be the first one to admit that what you did, not you personally, but what the legislature did with at the urging of the administration is to start an improvement process, which has not been completed. But it is true that the things that were effective last summer haven't had very long to manifest themselves.
Thank you. Senator Dyson.
I'll wait for Ms. Hall.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You made a comment, Mr. Zasinski, about businesses that come and go, and I think that's also true of the insurance industry, isn't it? Those people that we are counting on to go ahead and cover these workers' comp claims, that they also come and go.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't dispute that at all. I think you're absolutely correct that insurance companies do have a tendency to come and go. I guess what I would say to characterize my view of it is that they are heavily regulated, and in our state there is a guarantee fund. So there's a little, as an administrator of the benefit package, mm-hmm. I'm a little more relaxed about an insurance company that's being regulated by Director Hall or her cohorts in other states. A large company that's subject to any number of regulations as far as financial capabilities and investments and things like that. And nonetheless, it is absolutely true that they do go out of business. And
my next question, Mr. Lesanke, is under the self-insurance certificates, how many are right now in the state of Alaska are self-insured? How many entities? Or how many certificates have been granted?
Senator Olson, through the chair. At this time, sir, there are 31 individual entities that are self-insured, 23 that are private companies, and 8 that are public agencies, governments, and school districts.
Okay. My last question has to do with, they talk about 100 employees and a $5 million aggregate. On page 2 at the top, it says at least a $10 million aggregate. I was wondering, what's the discrepancy between the two numbers? I'm looking at version R.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'm not sure that I've had version R to look at long enough to pick that up, but I suspect that because the numbers have been changed, that it may just be a drafting error at this point. I believe that there was a requirement of $5 million in one of the earlier drafts, and I've heard the testimony about the subsequent draft having $10 million, so I suspect it's just an inconsistency due to drafting.
Thank you. And Madam Chairman, are we working off of version R? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Lesanke? Director Hall.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I would imagine at this point my strong opposition for this proposed legislation is quite well known. I would like to comment that and I think you've heard, the opposition is not just from the Division of Insurance. Mr. Lesanke from the Department of Labor Workforce Development has also evidenced that, as have some other groups. It's been an uncomfortable position to be in, to be in strong opposition to legislation proposed by members of this body. It's not something I've done often, and I don't do it lightly. It is a public policy decision, and I'd like to share some thoughts with you. As the lead regulator of the insurance industry in Alaska, it is the mission of the Division of Insurance to do 3 things. One is to enforce insurance statutes. Second is to protect the consumer. Third is to enhance the business environment. I think this legislation violates 2 of those things: consumer protection, and I will speak to both of these, and the enhancement of the insurance business in our state. I speak before you today to present my analysis of a proposal that I think is not good public policy. I had not seen the CS until I came here today. I had not asked for CS to be done in the Senate. I have certainly made my concerns about the bill known from the time it started last year. And as I have worked with one of the major sponsoring groups over the course of the summer, the concerns that I have, as we've gone through various committees, as I've voiced those concerns repeatedly, changes have been made. I'm not sure today, I have not had a chance to look at this to have an idea if my concerns are met or not. I'm going to address those concerns, it would appear from the testimony. Some are met, some are not. I will talk about my 4 major concerns. One is liquidity. I'm looking for real money to pay real claims. We have certainly increased from $5 million to $10 million a tangible net worth requirement for these groups. It's left up to the director to define tangible net worth. But as I understand, tangible, it means things you can touch, things you can see. I'm assuming when some director who follows me makes this definition, it will include buildings, cats, trucks, whatever the tangible net worth is. We can't pay work comp claims with buildings. We would guarantee a business would go out of business if they had to liquidate their assets to pay work comp claims. So I'm not today convinced that tangible net worth gives us the protection we're looking for. One of the, and I will certainly address one of the comments asked earlier about reciprocals and why I advocated that early in the process. Guarantee fund is my second concern. I do understand that the CS that I haven't read contains a provision for the guarantee fund. I have been in front of this body looking for solutions to an insolvent insurance company. There is a mechanism and it's worked. I will address that later in my comments also. The licenses that are required, I believe, are in the CS. I have made that an issue as I've talked. It's disturbing to me that I've had to go till the third to the end day of session and numerous committee hearings to have somebody now at the last minute bring these to the table. Process to deal with an insolvent group. The version I prepared my comments on had an ability for the director, if an association was insolvent, to withdraw their certificate. It had no process to do that. Insurance statutes clearly in Chapter 78 set out both rehabilitation and liquidation provisions. There needs to be a mechanism. Whether this bill now includes that, I really don't know. I would like to address some of the comments that have been made as I have made my opposition known. There's been an indication from a number of people to me that, well, you have the authority to decline applications. If one of these associations comes to you and presents the application, you can decline it. I think it's my obligation under Alaska statute to try to implement the things that this body passes. I can't imagine any director looking at applications and being able to deny that application because you didn't think, you didn't like the provisions of this particular chapter. I don't operate that way, and I can't imagine you would tolerate anyone operating that way. There are numerous financial requirements, as I've mentioned before. The most important element to me today is liquidity. A number of other states who allow self-insured associations do have working capital requirements. There needs to be money. The excess insurance is certainly there. Again, there is authority in this legislation for the director to make a determination of the level of excess insurance. You heard testimony earlier of an insurance company having a single claim reserved at $7.7 million. If, in fact, I were the director requiring an applicant to provide me evidence of insurance of $10, $15, $20 million excess insurance, I think I would probably get pushback that those were excessive. We don't need those. Our claims won't be that big. So there's a lot of balancing here. I would also present to you that I don't think this bill does what it's purported to do. We're looking at small employers. In this bill, there is a minimum $10,000 assessment from each member. So when you put five members together, there's an aggregate assessment of $300,000 to have a sufficient size to begin to work. But each individual member must have a minimum of a $10,000 assessment. And because it's self-insurance, we don't call it premium, we call it assessments. Many of our small businesses who are looking for relief, and I will certainly grant they need relief, are not going to be helped by this. They can't pay $10,000. That's what we're looking for, is ability to find options for those types of businesses. This is not going to do that. So what we're doing is benefiting larger groups and leaving those that I see in this point most vulnerable to still be in the system that admittedly, even by the sponsor statements, I'm sorry, not the sponsor statements, the proponent statements, is a broken system. My other major area of concern is my marketplace. I'm responsible for the insurance marketplace. Is it working wonderfully? Of course not. But am I seeing good things happen? I am, and I'd like to detail some of those. We have a small marketplace that's been alluded to, questions about population. As we allow more and more groups to opt out of that marketplace, our market becomes less and less attractive. We don't have people in here trying to compete for the business. There isn't enough business here for them to truly be able to use their assets and really get a return on those. I believe the term has already been used, and I've used it. There is certainly an ability to do cherry picking. I've heard testimony that, well, we will only take the best groups to do this. Well, what does that mean to an employer who's had a couple losses? Maybe isn't one of the best groups. There's an ability to do safety programs today. I think shame on any employer who doesn't have a safety program. That is the best thing to do for workers' compensation. I looked at someone's individual experience this week, a member of this body, who had a, it's called an experience modification that gave him a 13% credit on his business because he had good claims experience as an individual. Those things can happen, and they are an impact. There is today legislation that mandates premium credits for safety programs. So when we allow groups to pick off the best accounts, we're spreading the risk over a lesser group of employers who maybe by no reason of their own have a bad accident. I've insured employers, worked with employers for 20 years in Alaska. I've seen some incredibly serious claims. When a steel erector with an employee fall off a roof, that's a bad experience. Didn't mean they didn't have safety programs. They did, but they happen. Claims happen. It's very unfortunate. I'm going to give you some regulatory examples that I've gotten from people around the country who sit in my role that show some need for oversight and different kind of protection. Recently in Kentucky, a self-insured group became insolvent. Court ordered $90.7 million assessment. They were able to collect $68 million in cash and notes from the group members. There's a $22 million gap there. I don't know where that comes from. I understand all employers in Kentucky are being assessed for that. Ohio had a scandal. $50 million in work comp money was invested in rare coins. There was also a theft of over $1 million. We regulate the kinds of investments groups can make. New York has 62 workers' self-insured trust, work comp trust. In October, the Workers' Compensation Board in New York acknowledged that at least half were operating underfunded, and at least 12 were assessing members to reduce shortfalls that were running as high as $15 million per trust, $163 million in aggregate. Kansas recently, documents came out. Of the 11 self-insured funds, 5 either lost money or had negative fund balances. Self-insurance can work, but it has the same problems as insurance. The costs are high. The cost of systems, the cost of the benefits are high. I have seen in the 3 years that I've been in this position starting little glimmers of hope in our system. We have an assigned risk pool. It is supported solely by insurance companies. It has been a deterrent in our marketplace to competition. In the last 8 years, Alaska, for the first time in 2005, did not lose money in the assigned risk pool. That makes it a more attractive place for insurance companies to do business. Our market shares in the pool in 2003 were 20%. 20% of our premium was in the assigned risk pool. 2005, we've dropped that to 15%. More accounts are being written outside of that pool in a traditional market. Our guarantee fund, I mentioned that earlier. For me, it was probably the thing I would point to most since I've been coming before this legislature, the ability to find a fix for a huge hole that left over 800 injured workers with no benefits. It left over 400 Alaskan employers with a financial responsibility they never expected to have. This legislature worked with me to find a solution. We did increase assessments. It has increased the cost of workers' comp for the last couple years. 2006, those assessments were no longer made. That fix has worked, and that guarantee association has recouped money from other insolvent insurance company estates. I've worked with them diligently to try to do that. We've seen that work. I'm seeing expansions of insurance companies in our state. I've watched two insurance companies who had one adjuster operating out of their home open claims offices. increase their staff, sign long-term leases. Are they writing tons of business yet? No. But they are really looking at our market, and they're having an increased, renewed interest in expanding what they're doing here. A member of the House of Representatives just this week told me a story of a constituent that I would like to relay to you. He had a constituent who was complaining about having to close his business. He could no longer afford workers' compensation. You hear those comments from constituents. I hear those comments from employers. This gentleman told him that after we did reforms, this year he had bids from three insurance companies, reduced his cost by $50,000. Some of the prior speakers are correct. We haven't yet had a chance to see the full effects of reform. But I'm seeing signs in our workplace that this can work. California, from July of 2003 to January 2006, has seen a 46% decrease in their premiums based on the California Work Comp study. They also indicate in that same study that without the reform, that actually would have been a 60% decrease over what they would have expected. Pennsylvania, rates have dropped $100 million due to reforms. We have tried to do reform. We did reform last year. We've tried to do more. I'm really disappointed. There are a number of groups who have signed on to support this bill that did not become involved in the system reforms we did last year. And now they're looking for a carve-out. We can do a better job. I really think it's not a level playing field to let them out of a system that they don't want to help work with. I believe in Senate Labor and Commerce even, although they looked at me like I was nuts now, not the first time. We have ACOM guidelines. If we're going to look at something, we need to help our system. We need to do something about the cost. It really doesn't matter who writes that claims check. If the system costs are X, I've heard comments about reciprocals being top-heavy, charging too much. If you look at this bill, 35% is allowed there for administrative fees, at least 65% to pay claims. I don't think that's really any different than any system I see. I see the filings from insurance companies. We're seeing the same expense ratios at the top, what it costs to administer, what it costs to do things. This isn't that different. I'm not sure there's any savings here. I will wrap up. Thank you for your patience. Self-insurance in itself works well in some circumstances if safeguards are in place. I would really like to work with our system. I think it's broken. Director Lasanki and I have worked relentlessly for 2 years to work in that system. I have sat in this chair and proposed solutions. I don't think the solution is to let more groups opt out. If Alaska addresses the issues of cost, it too will see a reduction in premiums. If we just think changing the entity that writes the checks will bring down cost, I think we're mistaken. If we think claims can be controlled better by changing the entity that handles them, I think we're facing potential harm to injured workers. We have standards that have to be met. There are standards that are not in this bill where in my department we have, they're called unfair trade practices. That includes handling of claims. I have today in my office a very serious allegation against a company who's handling claims. They are probably right now subject to several hundred thousand dollars worth of fines for the way they handle claims. I want to make sure I still have that ability. I want to make sure that those injured workers are treated according to our statutes. I certainly mean no disrespect for the sponsors of this bill, but I really would urge you to consider the pitfalls and to oppose it.
Thank you. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. This has been very illuminating for me. This, your testimony reminds me of conversations that you and I had 2 or 3 years ago. We were trying to figure out some ways to help on the health insurance industry. And I remember you saying at that time that the more folks that are self-insured, in essence, the less attractive it makes our market here for carriers to come into the state. And the more self-insurance, more entities that have self-insurance, the more those are not under your purview to regulate them and look after the public interests. Did I hear you right? And does that same dynamics apply in this situation?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, absolutely. And the same dynamics apply with the fewer and fewer people that are under our regulation. I would also submit to you that the cost drivers are the same. The cost drivers in the increases in the cost of health insurance premiums are the same cost drivers that are in the workers' compensation premiums. The benefit system today has 67% of its cost in medical care. And as we see, we've seen that increase from approximately 40% 5 years ago. So it's the same symptom, and it's the same cause, and it's the same lack of regulation and oversight that we get when more and more entities are self-insured in either arena.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I heard the director correctly, that it looks like the workers' compensation issue that's been troubling the state over the last several years appears to be getting better, and there's companies that are looking at coming into Alaska and entering the marketplace. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I don't know that I have any new companies, although I've actually been talking to some. I'm seeing those that currently look to expand what they're doing to increase the investment in our state. I'm seeing our numbers become improved to the point that I'm seeing, and it's a little light at the end of the tunnel, but I think we do all of this as gradual. Nothing happens overnight. I would, at your leave, Madam Chair, say to Senator Dyson a similar thing. We have today in our office, and we're working with a new health insurance company. We have not had that for a long time. And I think that's a wonderful step. I was extremely pleased to hear that, where we're seeing new entrants into our market because of the statutory changes that we've made, because of some of the increases in a regulatory environment that encourage companies to do business here.
Okay.
I could, Madam Chair, I've been listening patiently for 20 minutes, but I haven't heard anything positive from the department on this bill, so I take that as you don't support this bill.
Senator Stedman, I think that's an accurate assessment of my position.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Director Hall. I know it's not pleasant to come and be disagreeable. Our inclination is usually to say, yes, I love your idea and I want to support it. And it's hard sometimes to say no. Are there any other comments or any questions? Are there any more comments about this bill? Senator Stedman.
Well, I think two things. When we have an industry like this, we have a department that regulates it, and they come in with a lot of concerns on the issue. And then we have, in this case, the Independent Insurance Agents Association, which represents the agents in the field opposed to this. I think we should proceed with some caution.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Linda, for being here today. I'm not hearing a great degree of support on this. I'm going to put this bill aside. Thank you for everyone who's testified. We'll move to House Bill 485. Regarding an act amending the State Personnel Act. Come forward, Janet. The title is nearly as long as the bill. Could you quickly explain this to us?
Yes, Madam Chairman, for the record, Janet Clark with the Department of Health and Social Services. House Bill 485 would move the pharmacist job class into the exempt service from their current placement in the classified service in state government. Madam Chairman, there are 10 positions that would be affected by this legislation in the Department of Health and Social Services and Corrections. The reason that we're advocating for this is that we've had tremendous difficulty in recruiting these key specialized medical positions in both departments, and we've lost pharmacists in many of our areas and are unable to fill these positions. Particularly in health and social services, they have to be specialized medical credentials. In the Pioneer Homes, we ask for geriatric experience and credentials for pharmacists, and they are key positions in the Pioneer Homes. Because of the professional level of expertise, we no longer believe that these positions fit in the classified service and that they're more similar to psychiatrists, physicians, the medical examiner, and the deputy medical examiner. And with that, Madam Chairman, because I know that you're quite busy during this time, those are my opening remarks, and I'll take questions.
Okay, does anyone have any question for Senator Dyson?
Are there bargaining unit issues related to this piece of legislation?
Through the chairman, Senator Dyson, these individuals would move out of their current bargaining membership. That is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know I've heard some departments speak that they're desperate to be able to hire pharmacists and simply cannot hire pharmacists. And it's over and above anything they anticipated, and we have to do something to respond to that because they are required. Are there any other questions of Janet on this issue? Senator Stedman, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick look at the fiscal notes. We have seven of them. Six of them are zero, but the Department of Correction shows a $30,000 increase. All the other ones are absorbing this change into their budgets. Would there be some reason why Corrections couldn't?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I think Department of Corrections can speak to that. Within the Department of Health and Social Services in the House Finance Committee, we did agree to zero out the fiscal notes and absorb the costs because of the pressure to get these positions. But we do have many more appropriations than Department of Corrections might, and we might have the ability to absorb it easier.
Sure.
Thanks. Char Griffin, Director of Admin Services for the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections inmate health care component has one pharmacist position. It's inmate health care is a single component, RDU. We were in for a supplemental appropriation last year. We've come in again this year for a supplemental appropriation. We try to make it within what we have, but it's been very difficult. Our population is not a healthy population by any means. We have a lot of catastrophic cases, and in our institutions, if we have vacancies because of 24/7 schedules, we fill them with overtime. So to absorb any additional personal services costs is very, very difficult for this component.
Any further questions?
No, thanks.
Is there any further information needed on the absorbing pharmacist into that status, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Any other information needed? Senator Wilkin?
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 485 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Yes, sir.
You know, Madam Chair, I just wanted to apologize again for being gone. The wheels were starting to come off on one of my bills, and I think we got them tacked back on with duct tape. But.
Okay, House Bill 485 moves from committee with individual recommendation. Fiscal note. Next is House Bill 190, required ID for purchasing alcohol.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Paula Ball, Representative Foster's office. Representative Foster is currently on the floor and will try to make it up if he can.
Thank you.
The bill you have before you will take a unique step in trying to reduce DUIs. Currently, Alaska has a very strict DUI statute, one of the strictest in the nation. And yet still approximately 30% of our fatal motor vehicle collisions involve a DUI. What this bill proposes to do is that if someone is convicted of a DUI and under the terms of sentencing and probation, a person is required not to consume alcohol. The term ROC, or restriction on consumption, would appear on their driver's license to indicate to vendors they are restricted on consumption. There is not a form requiring vendors to card. However, there is a financial incentive in line with the underage drinking provisions we have, whereas if they are carded and found to have that restriction, there can be a $1,000 civil penalty.
What causes the penalty?
The $1,000 civil penalty would be if someone goes and tries to purchase alcohol while they have that restriction and they are carded, the vendor can sue, basically, for a civil penalty.
The vendor that makes the sale?
Well, the vendor that carded the individual.
Okay, and makes the sale?
Well, doesn't make the sale because he carded them and found that restriction.
I'm confused. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, I'll try to help not make it worse. People who are underage at this point go in and try to buy alcohol. If the vendor, who is in great jeopardy if they accept some phony ID, intercepts a phony ID or the person isn't appropriate age, the vendor then can charge a $1,000 trespass fee for this underage person being on the premises. It has worked very well in Anchorage in discouraging young people from purchasing alcohol with phony IDs or no ID at all. And as I understand this bill, that would simply extend it to people who have had their privilege of buying alcohol restricted by the courts.
Okay, is the display on the license plate of ROC currently allowed, or does this allow it to happen?
This allows it to happen. It's not on the license plate. It's on the driver's,
the license.
Driver's license. Okay, yeah.
Senator Bundy.
Well, I'd like to speak in favor of the bill. I have to admit up front that it is a perhaps a half measure. We have these multiple DWI people out there. And someone my age who has multiple DWIs goes in to buy a six-pack of beer, they're not likely to be carded. However, in the unlikely event they were carded, they would now realize that they were subject to a $1,000 fine. And I think that is a step that I'm willing to take. And in addition, the incentive behind this bill was a multiple DWI offender who nearly killed one of our members' wife. And even though this is a half measure, I think something good ought to come out of a tragedy like that. And this would be a step, I think, in reducing multiple DWIs.
Okay, is everyone in agreement, though, that they want ROC on someone's license? Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I think this is a significant step here, maybe even a radical one that we're taking. I appreciate where we're heading. I'm a little concerned about the fiscal note, even though the fiscal note says it's indeterminate because of the unknown number of folks out there for whom this might apply. It would seem to me that is not such an unknown note, but indeed, have you explored what it will cost the DMV to be able to add this ROC designation on the card? Do they do other things like that, and is it really easy for them to do with their present equipment set up?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, the DMV has previously testified that it's clearly within their capabilities to print this, and it's pretty easy to do. As far as the fiscal note goes, let me find the section. It does outline that the person who has to get this printed on their license is responsible for all costs and fees associated with that.
If I may continue.
We do have DMV on the line, too, so Dwayne Bennett.
All right, so.
Go ahead, Senator Dyson.
So then the person who has had their license revoked has a responsibility, no, when their drinking privilege is revoked, has a responsibility of going to DMV and saying, you please put ROC on my, either my ID card or my my driver's license? Is that what I understood you to say?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that is correct. And it is page 2, line 31, that sets out that the department may, by regulation, set a fee for issuance of an identification card under this section.
Is the court currently doing orders to say you're restricted for consumption, consumption?
Yes, they are.
Senator Dyson.
In previous conversations on related issues, we've had kind of the IT problem of the court system's computers not being compatible with some other departments so that they can automate the delivery of those messages. Can that now happen in an automated fashion between the court system's computer records and DMV's?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I think either DMV or the courts, and we have Doug Wolliver here from the courts to answer, and one of them I think would be more appropriate.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, when it's appropriate in the conversation, I would enjoy an answer to that question.
Okay, thank you. Senator Wolf, did you have your hand?
Thank you. A couple of questions. Actually, I had three. Fiscal note was one, but I think we've chased that for the moment. The other was in our packets. There's a letter from the president of CHAR, Mr. Biwer. And in there, the first paragraph, he speaks of, will require bars and liquor stores to purchase expensive electronic equipment and hire personnel to operate that equipment. Could you help me as to what that equipment might be?
Senator Wilkin, through the chair, I believe that letter is out of date. However, I have Heather Beatty here who shepherded this bill through that portion of the discussion. And if I could bring her up here, she sure would be able to testify to that.
And the date I have on it is 5/7. So, oh, let's see. Oh, I'm sorry. Looks like the fax is 4/25. But yes, ma'am.
Heather Beatty, for the record, Legislative Aide to Representative Crawford. I believe Mr. Biwer perhaps misunderstands the bill. It does require that the DMV, when it's capable, make the ROC a scannable electronic item, but it requires a visual display in the license, similar to the little heart that's there for organ donors. So there would be no requirement that a licensee would have to buy any special equipment in order to determine whether or not the ROC was on the license.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. My third question is, we have a May 3rd letter in the packet from the Legislative Council, the attorney, and it seems like he asks some very pointed questions and, in fact, challenges the bill itself. So I just want to make sure that we have some response to that before we consider moving this on. Could you, either in writing or verbally, let us give some response to that May 3rd letter?
Representative Wilkin, through the chair, the amendment that I think he's specifically having an issue with was brought in House Judiciary, and it is what allows us to pick up ordinances or laws of a similar nature from another jurisdiction. And law had testified in judiciary about the workings of this and how it would work. There has been some disagreement between drafting and law on that issue. Probably the best person I could bring up for this would be Doug Wolliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Doug Wolliver.
Just a minute. I do want to notice that there was a previous letter that Senator Wilkin referred to I haven't received. And are you referring to a letter on this latest one, May 3rd, 2006?
May 3rd.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to be sure we had the right letter. Go ahead, Doug.
Doug Wolliver from the court system. I actually have not seen that letter. I'm not sure what the drafter's concerns are. My understanding with the amendment was a desire to capture, at the very least, municipal ordinances. Thank you, Senator. Municipal ordinances, for example, as you may know, pretty close to half of all misdemeanor DUIs are charged under the Anchorage Municipal Code and not under the state statutes. But I'm not sure what exactly what the drafter's concerns are. He's a good drafter.
I think it's a chain of information about who has been, how does the Department of Administration find out about all these various people, perhaps those from out of state, those in state, et cetera. And it would appear to me that only a complete revocation would bring it back to, DMV. And that's part of their concern. And then implementing and being able to identify people.
Madam Chair, I don't have any idea how DMV knows from when someone gets a conviction from out of state. If Mr. Bannock's online, I'm sure he knows that. Here in Alaska, the courts are required, and we do send any judgments that have an impact on a driver's license to DMV. So that's how they know what happens in Alaska, outside of Alaska. Mr. Bannock may know, but I'm not familiar with that. And if I could, Madam Chair, Senator Dyson, you had asked if we have an electronic connection yet with DMV for judgments. We don't. We continue to work on that as we do with all of our other electronic judgments. In fact, we have a committee. It's called MAGIC, which stands for Multiple Agency Blah 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 Blah. But it's a group that includes DMV and the Department of Law and all the other, and the court system chairs it, and all the other agencies that work together on justice issues. And we're constantly in the process of improving our electronic access. But at this time, we can't electronically send a judgment to DMV.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And you and I have been in on hearings and conversations where one agency transmits information to another, and then the person has to print it out and walk over to another terminal in another system and manually enter all that stuff. And here we have, very valuable information that is difficult to transmit, and particularly in real time. And I can see where this information would be valuable not only to DMV to be able to put it on the on the driver's license or an identity card, but also we've wanted for police officers to know, and from their real-time terminals, some of them in their cars, is this person prohibited from drinking? Does this home have a foster kid in it? We're doing pretty good on are there outstanding warrants, but all this other valuable information is difficult. And do you have any idea, are we months or years away from having these interdepartment electronic transfers from happening?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I imagine we're years away from getting everything we would like. Every year or so, we get another step closer. As you know, I believe the Alaska Public Safety Information Network, APSIN, is in the middle of getting a massive upgrade, and that's a lot of federal money, but it's millions and millions and millions of dollars, and it's a huge project. But there are some times where the court is, as you know, we have a new court computer system. Well, that allows us to transmit more information than we used to be able to. But then the receiving entity also has to have an upgrade to receive it. And we can send more and more information to Abson, but it doesn't do any good if there's no place in Abson to receive it. And the same with DMV. We're constantly getting better and better at electronic transmission of information, but it's a long, slow, and costly process.
And if I may follow, so, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but we're trying to make, are we 2, 5, or 10 years away from getting to where we need to be? Would you guess?
Through the chair, Senator Dice, I would guess more in the 5-year range, but like I say, in another year, there's probably something else that'll, another piece of the puzzle that will fall in. As you know, Senator French had a bill about bail conditions. Well, that's one of our priorities as well. And DMV issues are another priority. Collections issues with the Department of Law is another priority. Every year or so, we'll get another one of those in place.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Bundy.
And referencing Senator Dyson's question about the person that has to go down and say, I've been bad, give me a new license, it's a little more restricted than that. On the back page, it discusses how if you're convicted of a crime and the court sentences you to refrain from consuming alcohol, you turn in your license to the court. It's surrendered then, and then you've got 2 days to go down and get your new license. So it isn't quite as voluntary as it might seem. I have a question for the bill sponsor. I am concerned about this, the enforcement that Luckup has discussed here. Where in the bill is the amendment that was adopted that he's concerned about? I haven't been able to locate.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, page 2, line 9.
This is the U version.
Correct.
Okay.
And it's line 9, line 10, and then also page 4, lines 5, 6, and 7. And further background on that is there was an original amendment proposed in the Senate Judiciary Committee, which was a sponsor amendment, that would have changed it from reading instead of or similar law or ordinance from another jurisdiction, and would have simply read or a similar municipal ordinance, which would have only picked up in-state convictions in city ordinances. It was the Senate Judiciary Committee's will that they broaden that to capture as large a market as possible, which is why they drafted the amendment you see before you.
And what is the sponsor's opinion after looking at this memorandum from Mr. Luckup about the enforceability of these sections?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I am in actually the same position as Mr. Wolliver in that they did not forward us this letter.
Well, I'm in, as I said previously, in support of the bill. If it would strengthen the bill, and with the sponsor's agreement, I would remove that section. Were we to remove that, would that remove the requirement for a concurrence vote then?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I believe it would remove the requirement for a concurrence vote. However, we would lose approximately 50% of our DUI convictions, as we would lose those made under the Anchorage ordinance.
And maybe I'm asking for too big a bite. If we just remove this section that referred to out-of-state convictions, which certainly much easier to get DMV to communicate with Anchorage than it is with Alabama.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, we would have no problem with that. I do happen to have conveniently here a amendment that was proposed in Judiciary, which does exactly that.
But where does it say other state?
It says jurisdictions and lack of
section two
references other states.
Is a state?
I think that's the broad.
Okay.
If I could have at ease, so I could look at that amendment, or I'm.
I was just going to go ahead and let Dwayne Bannock start testifying. If you could go ahead and do that, Dwayne, could you help us out, please?
Good morning. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. My name is Dwayne Bannock with the Division of Motor Vehicles. I have a kind of a brief little bit of testimony, if I may give, and then if we could jump right into the into the questions, if that would be okay with you.
That'd be great.
Thank you for allowing us to testify today on this bill, especially allowing us to testify by telephone. I am here today with my manager of driver licensing, Ms. Carrie Hennings. So if you have really tough questions for me, I'm going to ask permission for her to jump in.
That's fine.
Division of Motor Vehicles has spent a tremendous amount of time on this bill, particularly with the original bill sponsor, in amendments, in trying to talk through some of the situations, both practical and philosophical. I would tell you that the Division of Motor Vehicles still struggles, both philosophically and practically, with this bill. I today will try to limit my testimony only to the practical side of it. First and foremost, let me apologize for the indeterminate fiscal note. It's the first indeterminate fiscal note that I have ever prepared and forwarded. I don't particularly like it. I'm not proud of it. I think that a person, a bureaucrat like myself, should be able to provide to your committee exactly what these costs should be, or a reasonable guesstimation, at least, of what these costs should be. Because of the unknown, though, particularly to how many customers this is going to entail, that's why we're troubled. I don't know if I'm going to need another full-time staffer to administer this program or not. I'll touch a little bit later on the question by Senator Dyson about our physical or our cost to actually create the mark on the license. Some of our concerns include one of the changes that was made are, if I may direct you to page 3. Forgive me, we just got version you handed to us a minute ago. Page 3, line 22 and 23. The Division of Motor Vehicles will be directed to stamp on this driver's license ROC, and ROC is an abbreviation for restriction on consumption. To your director, that appears to be a slight dichotomy in both the title and in section 1, where it speaks to premises, remaining on premises, and accessing premises. In some of the earlier testimony that was in committee, the discussion was that a person would be able to enter a licensed premise, they just simply would not be able to drink. While that is a certainly an opinion that can be debated, it does not appear that the bill in two different areas concurs with that same opinion. And as the head bureaucrat for the organization that is actually going to be handing these out over the counter, one of our questions that has not been firmly answered is, if a customer has this mark on their driver's license, may they go into a bar to order a Coca-Cola and watch the Super Bowl? May they indeed go to a liquor store and buy a bottle of wine? Or is the only thing they are prevented from doing is drinking alcohol? That's one of our questions. If I can move forward to Section 4 and Section 6, and in recognition of our time, Madam Chair, when I speak of driver licenses, the bill definitely covers both driver's licenses and identification cards. So please understand that when I'm using the phrase driver licenses, it also includes ID. And that's Section 4 and Section 6 are very similar to one another. And the instruction is given that the Division of Motor Vehicles shall cancel the driver's license. We, on the back page, as was earlier noted, the court system is given 2 days to give the information to the DMV that we are to cancel the license. In some instances, not every instance, will the court actually demand surrender of the license? Because you see, it is entirely possible that the customer doesn't have the license with him because he had already surrendered it to the police officer, and they have not yet come back to the DMV. So when the court gives us the information within 2 days that we shall cancel the license, that begs a few more questions from the DMV. Does the driver's license remain canceled until the customer gets their marked driver's license? And in fact, if their license remains canceled, is their privilege to drive then canceled? We assume the answer to that is yes. If a customer never returns to the DMV and they're in their driver's license was good for 5 years, and the time that their actual restriction has expired, is their driver's license still canceled? Or is it the job of the DMV to monitor the time period that was put on by the court order and then uncancel them? We hope the answer to that is no. So the answer would be that until the customer comes back to the DMV, the license would still remain as canceled. The answer to that is yes. Should there be a penalty then for driving with a canceled license, including being subject to arrest for driving with a canceled license because you didn't go to the DMV to get a license marked ROC for a alcohol-related event that may have happened and been passed years ago? Those are very, very difficult questions for us to comprehend how we will be responsible for administering it. Finally, Madam Chair, the DMV is worried. We are worried that we will not be able to satisfy the intent of the language in this bill. And we should be able to all agree that that intent is to reduce death and injury caused by drunk drivers. We've tried to implement some change at the Division of Motor Vehicles, and most of our ideas that we get good credit for are ideas that we didn't necessarily think of, but quite frankly, we stole them. We stole them from another state. We find no other states with substantially similar laws to this so that we can ascertain their best practices. Also, it's important to remember that this law will not stop lawbreakers from either obtaining or consuming alcohol. Remember, they're criminals that are under a court order not to do it today. This bill simply creates the physical proof of that order. But ask yourself this simple question that Senator Bundy alluded to. When was the last time you were carded prior to purchasing alcohol in a liquor store or when ordering a drink at a bar or a restaurant? As such, we find no measurable results between this bill and its goal of saving lives. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd be willing to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, Dwayne. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. You said something earlier, Dwayne, and thank you for your testimony, about whether it's a crime for someone to drive with their license revoked, suspended. Well, it certainly is in my estimation, isn't it? If the court revokes a license because of some other reason than DWI, that license is indeed revoked, and if a person drives without it, they're committing a crime, are they not?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, indeed, the correct phrase here is cancellation. There is a meaning of cancellation, there's a meaning for suspended and a meaning for revoked. The license is indeed canceled. My only hypothetical question that I pose to you, if the period for which the ROC was required has expired, is the driver still breaking the law if they have never gotten the ROC on their license?
If I might, I'll just, I guess, reverse that. If someone has their license suspended for a year, they are still breaking the law until they get a new license, even if that year is up, are they not?
Senator, generally, in every scenario, there is a requirement that the customer has to do at DMV. It's not simply a timing issue. For instance, if you're involved in an automobile accident and this is an insurance-related issue, in order for you, even after you've served your time penalty at the DMV, there's still something else you must do. Perhaps it's pay a reinstatement fee. Perhaps it's provide proof of insurance. Perhaps it's provide proof of restitution. So there is a thing that the customer has not yet done to make restitution to get their license back. In this cancellation, the cancellation is specific to a timing period. We've heard through other testimony, 6 months, 1 year, et cetera, but then once that timing period is done, our perfect customer in this scenario would have come into the DMV, gotten the marked license, comes back a year later and gets the new license without the mark on it. If they don't do that step and we've gone past their mandated time, are they in fact still breaking the law?
Any further
Thank
questions?
Thank you.
Senator Bundy. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bannock, I guess I realize that there's a fair amount of complexity to the details related to this bill, and obviously it's going to be a burden on the department. The simple question that I have is that, and I thought I heard it earlier on, but then I got confused later, is that you don't think that this bill will cut down on any of the DWI problems that we are having now?
Senator, through the chair, regretfully, that is my testimony today. I'd like to be able to say that your Division of Motor Vehicles is part of a solution as opposed to part of the problem. Yet, as we have debated this subject ad nauseum amongst ourselves and our managers, the practicality of a customer actually being refused alcohol that ties directly to his or her driving an automobile is nearly non-existent.
With all due respect, Madam Chairman and Mr. Bannock, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further Senator Bundy?
Yeah, and I'm sorry to take so much time. Under the current scenario, someone is restricted from driving or restricted from using alcohol in driving, and he's stopped by a police officer. Is that restriction in absence so that when they run the driver's license number, it comes up immediately, or would there be the use of looking at the license with the ROC on it?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, we believe both. It's important to this debate because we know that many people will not be compliant. We assume many people will not be complying with this law, yet it will only be law enforcement and others that have access to the system that you've just referenced that would actually know that. If I were the subject of this and I did not go to the DMV to get my new license, yourself, the bartender, the person at the liquor store would look at my license in my pocket and would not be able to tell that I was under such restriction. A police officer or other law enforcement officer would be able to tell that by accessing the database.
Yeah. So, if I might, there is some hammer left. One, if you should happen to be carded because of your picture was in the paper as a chronic DWI something, you could be subject to a $1,000 fine. But more likely, if you were stopped, and as you point out, these people tend to be scofflaws anyway. If you were stopped for another infraction and you had not complied, then you could be subject to arrest for that.
Senator, we believe that is accurate, that you could be arrested for driving on a canceled license because you did not come to the DMV to get the ROC, even if the time-mandated period by the court had expired.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Prior legislation, we had testimony from Ms. Hall, who I think a great deal of and has done a wonderful job in her position. I think the same in Mr. Bannock. I think he's done a great job with DMV. My complaints in my department have fallen to zero. And when he questions this bill, I then align myself with his concerns. I think this bill has great intentions, but I think there's a lot of work to be done before we put it into law. So I won't be supporting it, but I would encourage the sponsor to bring it back next year and just do a little more work with the agencies so that when it gets back to us next year, it isn't there aren't so many questions about how it's going to be put in place, because Senator Dyson said it, this is not a minor step. Thank
Senator
you.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. I guess I identify with Co-Chair Finance's remarks, and also I'm reminded of a bill I think Senator Huggins brought forward that allows folks who are not legal age to drink in our state, who might be going to the veterans VFW meetings and so on and so forth, and until he got, I think, a little bill change here, they couldn't even go there for social events and so on and so forth with even though they didn't drink. And the access to premises portion of this bothers me as well, and if this does not pass this session, I would encourage the folks who are working on it for next session to look at that as well. What we want to do is prohibit folks who have disqualified themselves from the privilege of drinking from drinking, not necessarily be on any premises, restrict them from being on a premises where there may be drinks being served. I think that as I read this bill, it misses that piece there as well.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Senator Bundy.
Oh, just a closing comment. Respectfully disagree. I know it's a small hammer, but it's still a little move in the right direction, and I would like to see us move the bill. Understand the wishes of the committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being with us today, and we'll look forward to hearing more about this next year.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. House Bill 150. Are you doing that, Heath? Okay, we are really under the gun, so let's get this going. And
thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Heath Hilliard, staff to Representative Anderson. I have nothing further to add at this time, but we'll be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Okay, are there any questions about House Bill 150? Have all of you heard this bill? I know we heard it in Hess. Senator Stedman, have you heard this bill? It has to do with, we had it in this committee.
We had it yesterday,
so. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, I've heard too many in the last few days. Okay, now this is a new chapter to read from the licensings of radiographers. Does anyone need any more information? Senator Bundy.
Yeah. Well, this is one of those 5149 for me. Some of my constituents don't approve of this bill. Some of my friends like it, and I always agree with my friends and my constituents. one of the things that a concern that I did hear, I think, from you, Madam Chair, was, is this then going to create another bureaucracy, another board, another enlarging government unnecessarily? And I want to be on the record that I do not endorse or support that, and hope we can have some assurance that that isn't indeed not the way this bill is heading.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Yes, if I can recall a testimony yesterday, Madam Chairman, it seemed like there was some concern that it wasn't needed, and the issue of some of the different types of radiation and impacts were questioned, so I'm kind of neutral on this.
Kind of lukewarm on this, is that what you said? Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the question I asked yesterday was, what problem are we trying to solve? And that question resides with me still today. With all respect to the people that have worked on it, I think this is feel-good legislation. And we may feel good to pass it, but it doesn't do anything. And in fact, I think it has more of I think it has more potential to harm places in rural Alaska that this doesn't touch my community, but it certainly may touch others. I just don't support it. I just don't think it's necessary.
Senator Dyson.
And I appreciate that. I am of the opposite opinion. and they've done a pretty good job here of trying to, in this bill, make allowances for folks to get the level of training and supervision in remote areas. And I'm impressed with the testimony of our public health director, Dr. Monsager, who spent quite a bit of time informing me of the long-term damages to folks' health from overexposure and what the industry has learned over the last 25 years. And so I'm a yes vote.
Senator Hoffman?
And I agree with Senator Wilkin. I think that this bill just does additional harm in rural Alaska. So I am opposed to the legislation.
Keith, it's not looking good.
Madam Chairman, can I make a comment?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Certainly, I want to go on record that as far as X-ray techs and those people that are dealing with the radiological department of healthcare delivery systems, I'm not opposed to having them educated and continue to have continued training for a period of time. I see this, though, as going as a step too far in that direction. Certainly, I have had training. I remember the first radiological procedures that I did was doing a barium swallow with an image intensifier, and that was a fair amount of time ago. And one of the more uncomfortable things are the barium enemas that have been done. And so I'm not taking this lightly, but I think that in this particular case, that the bill would, in the end, cause a strain in the area that I tend to practice medicine.
Thank you very much. Are there any more comments? I don't have a motion.
Would you like one?
Senator Dyson, would you like to move?
Okay. I move that report from committee HB 150. With the attached fiscal note, individual recommendations.
Is there an opposition?
I object.
Okay, would you take the roll, please? I'm moving out. House Bill 150.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Stedman?
No.
Senator Wilkin?
No.
Senator Green?
No.
2A, 5A.
Thank you very much,
so thank
the committee.
You for
I appreciate
it. To us, and we look forward to working with you in future. As a reminder, we are attempting to schedule a photo shoot tomorrow afternoon for this committee here at about 1 p.m. So everybody is looking good tomorrow afternoon for our photo.
We're going to be sitting at the desk. What are we going to
be? There have been one in the past that was just a nice one. It had everyone seated in their position and then
on our places with bright, shiny faces.
Absolutely, bright, shiny faces. And so, Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, just for your knowledge and Senator Hoffman, we're going to try to get the conference committee going at 4, but we're going to work with the House, and when they can let those folks go for about a half hour, that's about as much time as we're going to need. So if you could just stay in touch with them to just be flexible between 4 and 6, we'll try to get that done.
Okay. Thank you very much, you. Senator Wilkin. Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Do we have any more... Are we planning to schedule any more hearings for bills?
My goodness, I hope not. But I'm not going to say we're definitely no in case something.
All right. And when do you anticipate we will meet again?
I don't have a schedule. Tomorrow at 1 for sure for photos.
For looking good.
Absolutely.
Besides feeling good.
That gives me enough time.
Madam Chair, while I was talking, James handed me a note. So conference committee, we're going to shoot for 5 o'clock.
5 p.m. today. Okay, very good. We are adjourned.